We have a good message to give in the sense that the Australian Council of Learned Academics, the Chief Scientist in New South Wales, the Hawke Report in Northern Territory, the Reith Report, Royal Society, etc., have always said there's no scientific reason to interfere with fracking. It just needs to be properly regulated.
There is massive opposition, though, isn't there? And before you spoke, the State Minister for Resources, Anthony Roberts, was saying that they think they can move this industry forward in a measured way, but the industry itself has to come to grips with the extent of the public opposition.
Oh, look, the public opposition is palpable, and I think it's done out of the fear of the unknown rather than on scientific facts. The trouble is, with scientific facts, you need more than 160 characters to communicate. So in the old days when journalists were able to actually be a conduit in checking off the facts, you went for the hearts and minds argument, and now you have to go for the hearts first and hopefully get the emotions down sufficiently to allow the intellect to engage. I think there's been an enormous failure of communication of precisely how important gas is to particularly the New South Wales economy, where I think that the minister that morning said there was 300,000 gas-related jobs in New South Wales in jeopardy. And this is not for electricity generation. The shortage means there won't be any gas-fired electricity generation, so it's not in competition with renewable energies. You can't use electricity to manufacture glass, plastics, fertilisers, coating of steel for construction of housing, transportation. In Brisbane, for example, there's compressed natural gas buses, and I think also in Sydney.
The issue, though, is that there's this emerging export market for gas, and it could well be that even if there is a plenty of gas around in Australia, most of it will bypass New South Wales, creating a shortage in order that it can be sold for a high price elsewhere.
Yeah, look, that always is a problem with the market economy, but that's where the issue of what's called NIGI, the Northern Territory Interconnect, comes in. Clearly, that is aimed not at the export market, but giving 30% of New South Wales gas demand. At the end of the day, I think that there's companies like myself would prefer to supply the domestic market. Why? I don't want to take US dollar exchange risk. I don't want to take oil risk. My biggest problem is getting capital. And so to be able to borrow on a stable A-dollar contract is going to cheapen my interest costs like absolutely nothing on earth. I can't go in the early stages through the swings.
But you're not prepared to support, say, a gas reservation policy, which might be good for a company like yours that wants to service the domestic market.
One, I don't think it's necessary. And two, I think that if you're rationing something that needs to be rationed because there isn't supply, the idea of getting the Kremlin to organise that market is not necessarily going to create the correct market forces and risk to drilling. But at the end of the day, people have to recognise Australia is a federation, and Section 92 of the Constitution says trade and intercourse between the states shall be absolutely free. South Australia has every right to sell at the highest possible price to Queensland rather than to New South Wales and to get its royalties based on that higher price. New South Wales can't demand that South Australia subsidises New South Wales manufacturing.
Richard, when you addressed the Gas Outlook Conference, one of the key things you were trying to convey was how to win the PR battle. Can you explain how you thought you won it in some of the areas that you've been operating in?
First of all, I started with the saying from Lyndon Baines Johnson, the President of the United States, that all politics were local, which meant that you should be concentrating on the town hall rather than Whitehall, as I put it. And so one of the things we did was we recognised that if you go into a new rural area, there is going to be some fear of the unknown. So the first thing we wanted to do was engage with the local community. We had regular board meetings out there. I went out there quite regularly. It became pretty apparent to me that there was a number of major issues around the Chinchilla Miles area. Banks were closing. But the most pressing social issue, well, two of them were, it was the highest unemployment rate in Queensland at the time. And the parents got used to the idea that as soon as their kids finished secondary school, that was the end of them seeing it, what I call the donutting of the town. So obviously I had a dream, an impossible dream, to try and change that around.
you said also in your speech that the work that you'd been doing in Alice had produced untold good for the Indigenous people there.
We have made an active campaign to do three things. The first one is what I call family values for working families, and that is to try and use Alice as our base and use technology so that our employees can go home every night live in Alice Springs and drive their car to work and drive back every night so they can see Jenny play netball and Johnny play footy. The second one is that to the extent that we have to have a remote operation, we will try and employ based in Alice Springs, and the roster will be bust from Alice Springs. And the third one is to maximise the Indigenous employment through training and various others, and we've already been quite successful with 30% of our operating workforce being Indigenous extraction.